Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, October 10th, 2018. We may begin with the feature story, Monster in the Classroom. An alleged predator, a school leader accused of a cover-up, a precedent-setting prosecution. The Indy investigates what happened inside the Montessori School of Raleigh and what it could mean for sexual abuse cases everywhere. Here's an editor's note preceding this article. Throughout this story, the names of two sexual abuse survivors and their parents have been changed to protect their privacy and for clarity, including when they or their pseudonyms or initials appear in documents and police and court records. Part 1, Professional Boundaries. Carolyn Edison knew something was wrong. It wasn't just that Nick Smith had boundary issues or that his middle school students at the Montessori School of Raleigh viewed him less like an authority figure and more like a friend. He seemed like one of us, one recalls. It wasn't even Smith's peculiar closeness with some adolescent girls, and one ninth grader in particular, or that his unnerving behavior during a school trip had led another girl to complain to her father. In isolation, perhaps, each of these things could be explained. But to Edison, MSR's middle school language arts director, the totality suggested something more disquieting. So a few weeks before the 2012-13 school year began, she took her concerns to her new boss. Nancy Arashedi, who'd become head of the school just a month earlier, was evidently troubled by what Edison told her. On August 7, 2012, according to an email exchange obtained by the Indy, she told Edison that she'd had time to reflect on what you'd shared with me and also to seek advice from our school attorney. I am also virtually certain I will not allow Smith to attend the overnight in 2 weeks, a reference to one of the several chaperone trips MSR students take throughout the year. Arashedi asked Edison to put in writing what she'd seen and heard. On August 13th, Edison did, cataloging a series of anecdotes from the previous 2 years. In October 2010, she wrote, during an overnight trip to a farm, Nick was in one of the girls' rooms late into the night, about 11 o'clock, for a gossip session. In March 2011, during an overnight trip to Chapel Hill, Smith, the only chaperone, played a game of Would You Rather with a group of teenage girls in their hotel room. One of the girls' fathers told the Indy that Smith entered the room where three boys were on one bed and three girls were on the other and told the boys to leave. He turned on an R-rated movie and asked the girls if they'd rather kiss a particular male MSR student or a female student. After the father relayed the incident to the school board of trustees, Smith was informally reprimanded. Nick told me that the then head of the school, Meg Thomas, told him that he needed to be careful in his interactions with the girls, but that she was not going to put the parents' written concern in his file. Edison wrote to Arashedi. Then came, in hindsight, the most consequential revelation. In January 2012, Edison wrote, she observed Smith and a ninth grader, Stephanie Johnson, again note, not her real name, working alone in the math room for several weeks. Starting about the middle of the year, they started to go up to the Pottery Shack alone during study hall. The Pottery Shack is a metal building on MSR's sprawling, secluded Briar Creek Secondary School campus used for arts and crafts. That spring, Edison continued, I observed Nick and Stephanie going to or returning from the Pottery Shack on two occasions after school. As well, I observed several times when Nick and Stephanie spent recess together, walking alone or up and down the road leading to the middle school. In addition, she wrote, during a trip to Charleston, South Carolina, a teacher witnessed Smith and Stephanie on the beach alone playing with one another's hands. Edison, who left MSR in 2013, declined to comment for this story. The day after Edison's email, Arischetti admonished Smith, a 31-year-old NC State graduate who taught math at MSR since 2006. He was forced to sign a behavioral plan that included such directives for professional conduct as, you should never socialize or interact with students in a way that you would socialize or interact with adults. You are not to be alone with any student on school property or on school trips, and you are not to enter a girl's hotel room on school's trips. Failure to abide by the directives in this plan will result in a first warning as outlined in the employee handbook, the plan concluded. A few weeks later, Edison informed Arischetti that on a trip early in August, Smith had gone to the girls' floor of a hotel to wake them up. While what he did is certainly not as egregious as some of his previous behavior, Edison wrote in an email, there really is no reason that he needed to approach the girls' rooms at all when there are female chaperones who can do that inside instead. This prompted Edison to ask, is it your expectation that Nick will not go on trips at this point? He is making plans to go to the beach on an intercession trip in October and has offered to go on any and all trips that arise. My previous understanding was that you did not want him to go on trips. Is this still the case? My conversation with Nick was explicit and thorough, Arischetti replied. Given our understanding at the time, there was no need for me to excuse him from trips. Unless I get some real clarity about his recent choice, this may change. It didn't change. Nicholas Conlon Smith continued teaching at MSR and chaperoning trips until November 7, 2017, when he was arrested on more than 20 charges of statutory rape and child pornography stemming from a sexual relationship Raleigh police said he had with Stephanie in 2011 and 2012. Smith is currently in the Wake County Jail on a bond of more than $3 million and faces decades behind bars. In January, Stephanie, her youngest sister, Kristen, also not her real name, and their parents filed a lawsuit against Smith Arischetti and MSR, alleging not only that Smith had abused Stephanie on the school's watch, but that he'd later molested Kristen as well. In March, a grand jury indicted Smith on separate charges of grabbing Kristen's breasts and buttocks and attempting to kiss her. The lawsuit claims the school willfully failed to take appropriate action that would have prevented the egregious sexual molestation of Smith's youngest female students, including, but not necessarily limited, to Stephanie and Kristen. MSR stood by its head of school. When the Indy reported on the lawsuit in early May, the Board of Trustees said in a statement that it supports our school's leadership and will vigorously defend our school's actions. Arischetti remained on the job, collecting a salary of about $200,000, according to court documents, up from merely $158,000 tax records show her making a few years earlier. If that's where the story ended, this might be just another teacher's sex scandal with a not-so-uncommon twist of a school accused of failing to intervene. But it's not. On May 15th, the Wake County Grand Jury took the unprecedented step of indicting Arischetti on charges of aiding and abetting Smith in taking indecent liberties with a child and of contributing to the delinquency and neglect of a minor. In recent years, a handful of school administrators around the country have been prosecuted on misdemeanor charges of failing to report allegations of sexual abuse, but this was different. The aiding and abetting count is a felony that carries the possibility of more than 3 years in prison. By all accounts, no charges like these had ever been brought in North Carolina, perhaps even anywhere in the United States. Wake County Assistant District Attorney Melody Shaitikika, a veteran sex crimes prosecutor, told Indy she's unfamiliar with any similar cases. Advocates and experts say they aren't either. Making the charges stick won't be easy, legal experts say. The indictment accusing Arischetti of not just failing to report Smith, which would be rare enough, as only one such case was brought in North Carolina in 2017, but with unlawfully, willingly, and feloniously facilitating his abuse. To convict her, says Jeff Wetley, director of the NC Judicial College at UNC School of Government, Shaitikika must convince jurors that Arischetti either knew about sexual abuse and declined to act, or that she ignored obvious red flags and was playing ostrich. The charges were never going to fly, says Steve Saud, a former Wake County prosecutor turned criminal defense lawyer. Never going to fly. Arischetti's indictment didn't happen in a vacuum. Over the last year, the hashtag MeToo movement has brought to the foreground a parade of powerful men who use their privilege to abuse women. Perhaps more germane, high-profile sex abuse scandals involving the Catholic Church and Penn State, Michigan State, and Ohio State universities, as well as many more everyday incidents of educator misconduct, have exposed officials who protected prisoners instead of stopping them. Every case we see, somebody knew something, says Carmen Durso, a Boston attorney whose firm specialized in representing sexual abuse survivors. In response, he said, prosecutors have been taking a more aggressive posture toward administrators, signaling that they're going to be charged if they sit back and let things happen. To date, however, they've been a little reluctant to send them to jail, instead opting to give them a record and get them the heck out of education. But in Wake County, the district attorney's office is taking a harder line, targeting Arischetti as if she were Smith's accomplice. That's where we'd like to see all prosecutors going with these cases, says Terry Miller, president of the organization Stop Educator Sexual Abuse Misconduct and Exploitation. Because when they do fail to make these reports, it is deliberate child endangerment. Through her attorney, Arischetti declined an interview request, but since her arrest, MSR has insisted that while Arischetti tried to address Smith's boundary issues, the head of school wasn't aware of allegations of sexual abuse and shouldn't be held responsible for the teacher's actions. If anything, her defenders argue, Arischetti isn't the villain, but rather a victim of an overzealous prosecutor. For the last 5 months, the Indy has probed these dueling narratives, as well as the turmoil that has engulfed MSR, drawing on dozens of interviews, court and police records, and internal emails and documents not yet made public. The first comprehensive look at what had happened at MSR, this investigation reveals that, in 2016, Arischetti was told not only about Smith's boundary issues, but also that he touched Kristen Johnson's thigh and grabbed her hips. Despite that, and despite Edson's warning 4 years earlier, Arischetti did not report Smith to the authorities, nor did she fire him. Whether this inaction raises to the level of criminal conduct is a complicated question. What is clear, however, is that if Stephanie Johnson hadn't broken her silence, Nick Smith might still be in an MSR classroom today. For 5 years after she matriculated out of MSR, Stephanie said nothing to her parents or siblings, let alone the cops. But last fall, when Stephanie was a junior in college, Kristen confided in her that Smith had fondled her, according to police records. After that, things moved quickly. Stephanie disclosed her and her sister's relationship with Smith to a college counselor. The counselor called Child Protective Services, which called the Raleigh Police Department on September 28, 2017. By October 9th, a detective was assigned to the case. On November 7th, with his sister's statement in hand, police had Smith in handcuffs. Taken together, police records and documents from the Johnsons' lawsuit paint a vivid and at times graphic picture of the abuse the sisters say occurred at MSR between the fall of 2011, when Stephanie entered ninth grade, the final year of Montessori Middle School, and the spring of 2016, when Kristen abruptly exited the school. According to these documents, Smith began flirting with and grooming Stephanie for sexual abuse in 2009 when she was 12 and in the seventh grade. Soon after Stephanie started ninth grade, Smith kissed her in the pottery shack. Not long after, he began raping her, police said. According to a probable cause affidavit, these acts took place on a regular basis throughout the school year. Smith and Stephanie sent and received sexually explicit photos to one another when Smith saved onto her computer in a password-protected file to hide them from his then-wife, according to the affidavit. They divorced in 2014. Smith told Stephanie that he loved her, the lawsuit says, and assured her that they had a normal boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. Stephanie was one of just 8 students in her ninth grade class that year, 3 girls and 5 boys. Like the rest, she called her teachers by their first names, but she called Smith Senior because there was another Nick on MSR staff. That nickname had an unintentional irony. Despite a receding hairline, Senior looked youthful, almost boyish. He was friendly and easygoing, popular among most teachers and students. When Stephanie left MSR, their relationship ended, the records say, though they chatted online until 3 months before Smith's arrest. According to the lawsuit, as Stephanie grew older, Smith stated to Stephanie that he would take his own life if she ever told anyone about their relationship. After Kristen started seventh grade at MSR in 2014, police and court records say Smith began to repeat the grooming pattern. Kristen later told police that on several occasions during her eighth grade year, Smith touched her hips, thighs, and breasts, including once when he groped her breasts at a Harris Teeter. More rebellious and less deferential to authority than her older sister, and also forewarned about Smith by an older stepsister who had also gone to MSR, Kristen fought off her teacher's advances. In March of 2016, Smith attempted to friend Kristen on Snapchat. Kristen blocked him, and Smith got angry. 2 months later, Kristen's parents found out and complained to Arachetti, both about the social media overture and that Nick Smith had been touching Kristen and pursuing a personal relationship with her. This according to the documents the Indy obtained. Arachetti, the lawsuit says, told the Johnsons that she did not believe what she was being told and she refused to take any action with respect to their complaints. It's not fully accurate that Arachetti took no action, just that she didn't do so right away. About 3 weeks later, on June 2, 2016, she had Smith sign a second behavioral plan, virtually identical to the one he'd signed in 2012, including directives not to be alone with students and to avoid girls' hotel rooms. The only difference, a warning that a third offense could lead to termination. The date of Smith's two behavioral plans, August 14, 2012, and June 2, 2016, form the bookends of Arachetti's indictment, between which she did aid and abet Nicholas Smith to take or attempt to take immoral, improper, or indecent liberties with Kristen. Specifically, the defendant had previously sick knowledge of inappropriate behavior toward the other students in whose care he was entrusted as a school teacher. The defendant, as headmaster, was in a position to act and failed to do so, which resulted in Kristen being sexually abused. This raises two questions. The first, straightforward, an issue of fact. What exactly did Arischetti know? The second is a matter of interpretation, ambiguous even in state law. At what point would Arischetti have known enough that not going to the cops was aiding and abetting him, the legal equivalent to driving a getaway car after a robbery? A teacher sending an unwanted Snapchat request might be inappropriate, but it's not criminal. Neither, for that matter, is engaging teenagers in a game of would you rather. Smith holding hands with Stevens would arouse suspicions, but even that isn't explicitly sexual behavior. That's the school's position, that Arischetti didn't know enough to have committed a crime. In an email to faculty the day after her arrest, the Board of Trustees said that it had no information or evidence that Nancy was aware of any sexual assault. When presented with concerns about Nick Smith's professional boundaries, Nancy's took their concerns very seriously. During a forum with teachers the day after that, a board member added, "We have absolutely no data whatsoever, no behavioral plans, no anything that suggests that Nancy had any awareness of any inappropriate sexual behavior whatsoever. The charges at her stems from concerns related to Nick Smith's professional boundaries that were shared with her during her first month of school," a reference to Edison's email. This distinction is important. The prosecution's case against her is going to rise and fall on what she knew, says Doreen Lambillette Coleman, a Duke law professor. Specifically, she said, it's going to rise and fall on whether Arischetti knew not only that Smith was behaving improperly, but whether she knew that he engaged in sexual touching. In other words, touching the genitals, buttocks, breasts, or kissing. Nothing in the public record indicates that Arischetti knew Smith had sexually touched Stephanie Johnson. This could be a key to Arischetti's criminal defense, as the aiding and abetting charge is rooted in the idea that Arischetti's failure to act in 2012 enabled Smith to abuse Kristen years later. But there is evidence that in May of 2016, Arischetti was told that Smith had inappropriately touched Kristen. In a May 6th letter to Arischetti, which the Indy has obtained, the Johnsons lodged a formal complaint against Smith. If his behavior continued unabated, they wrote, they'd have to withdraw Kirsten from the school. As a result of Mr. Smith's unprofessional behavior, they added, Kristen has experienced considerable distress this semester. This has included tears, worry, anxiety, anger, embarrassment, stomach aches, and confusion. They explained that they had found that messages between Kristen and one of her siblings in which Kristen described Smith's conduct. In addition to what Kristen describes in the text messages, they wrote, she reports that Mr. Smith has called her away from classwork to ask about how she feels about him and why she doesn't like him. She states that she feels like his eyes undress me, and is creeped out by him. When she referred to being touched multiple times one day at school by him, she is referring to him repeatedly putting his hand on his shoulder, arm, and thigh while trying to have unwanted non-academic conversations with her. The Johnsons also sent Arischetti a transcript of Kristen's recollections of her conversations with Smith. In April, they wrote, Smith pulled Kristen out of a humanities class and ordered her to sit on a swing. She refused, saying she'd rather stand, and pointed out that the entire class could see them. You're being disrespectful to me, Smith told her, according to the parents' account. I feel like you're doing this on purpose. You don't treat me like the other teachers. Every time you look at me, you give me a death stare. I know you're deliberately making me uncomfortable by the way you are treating me. Later in the conversation, Kristen told Smith point blank why she didn't like him. Don't act like you haven't done this before, My sisters warned me about you. Which one? Smith asked. My sister, Kristen said. A source familiar with the Johnsons' version of events says Kristen was referring to her stepsister, who is younger than Stephanie, but older than her, and also went to MSR. The stepsister is not part of the family's lawsuit, and Smith has not been accused of abusing her. I get it now what they meant, Kristen continued. I feel violated and uncomfortable, and I don't feel good at school. I just want to finish and get out of here. Am I the reason that you hate this school? Smith said. Yes, you're a big part of it, and other stuff too. Once again, Arischetti was alarmed. At 10:33 p.m. on May 9, 2016, Arischetti fired off an email to Smith, who'd recently left to chaperone a middle school trip to Europe. The Johnson, she wrote, delivered a package to me today containing a letter and other information outlining allegations against you with regard to their daughter, including inappropriate touching and conversations, and a recent attempt by you to engage with her on Snapchat. Arischetti continued, I will conduct a full investigation upon your return. In the meantime, I expect you to comport yourself as the highest level of professional in carrying out your duties as an MSR teacher on this trip. You need to exercise impeccable judgment. Make sure you are never alone with any student and that you do not enter any student room for any reason. If you are engaging in social media with any students, you need to immediately cease those activities. Kristen, she said, added, also apparently stated that you have done similar things to another female student who was on the European trip. Therefore, I want you to exercise particular caution in your dealings with her. Arischetti's response to Kristen's allegation appears to run counter to the protocol outlined in MSR's 2015-16 employee handbook, which says that when the head of school is told of suspected abuse, she must report it to the authorities. The head of school, the handbook says, is not to act as a screen of reports, but as a liaison or channel. But Arischetti didn't alert social services or the police. And because MSR failed to protect Kristen, the Johnson's lawsuit said she was forced to leave the school. Part 2. Tyrant. Even before Nancy Arischetti's arrest, MSR was racked by turmoil. Afterwards, things only got worse. By the end of the school year, MSR had lost at least one-fifth of its 78 faculty members. More departed over the summer. Six faculty members, including outspoken Arischetti critics, were let go. Some remaining teachers worried that they would be fired for speaking out, too. Some parents pulled their kids amid the tumult. The tension boiled over to the point that school officials were worried MSR would collapse entirely. In late May, after a meeting between the Board of Trustees and faculty, a teacher sent an email to MSR staff. Quote, the board members would like for us to present a unified front for the parents. This would help reduce the risk of future family departures and help make certain that the school is able to open in the fall. End quote. In interviews over the summer, several members of the MSR community wondered the same thing. Why was the board so determined to stick with Arischetti when many schools would have dropped her at the first hint of scandal? For months, the Indy sought answers to this and other questions, requesting interviews with board members either directly or through the school's spokespeople. In late August, after these efforts proved fruitless, the Indy submitted 18 detailed questions to MSR Board of Trustees. In late September, the school responded with a four-sentence statement attributed to Chairman Joe Lee that concluded, at this time, we do not believe it is appropriate, helpful, or productive to comment on these matters outside of the legal process. In August, the school's lawyers also filed a motion to prevent Robbie Jessup, the Johnson's attorney, from sharing the contents of depositions with the media. Among those unanswered questions is why Arischetti, now 55, was hired to helm the school in the first place. On paper, she wasn't an obvious choice. She'd never run a school before, let alone one with 400 students that charges up to $19,390 in tuition and had a limited background in Montessori culture. A decade and a half before she was appointed head of school, Arischetti was a New York City lawyer married to Goldman Sachs Vice President Evan Mishula. When she decided to get pregnant with the first of her three children, she left her law firm and started a consulting business for Big Apple parents, according to a 1998 book she co-authored called Who Knew Raising Kids in New York Could Be This Easy? Soon after, Mishula started his own hedge fund, and in 2002, they exchanged their Park Avenue for a five-bedroom house in Greenwich, Connecticut. By 2004, however, the hedge fund had gone belly up, according to Securities and Exchange Commission documents, and Arischetti had moved with her three kids to California, where she took a fundraising job at a private school in Los Angeles. This according to court records and her LinkedIn page. Then in 2006, Mishula pleaded guilty to mail fraud as part of a scheme to defraud investors of more than $500,000. He was sentenced to 21 months in federal prison, and in 2007, Arischetti filed for legal separation. The next year, she was granted a divorce. In 2010, Arischetti moved to Raleigh, where her older sister lived, and accepted a position as MSR's Director of Development and Alumni Relations. Within 2 years, she was appointed head of school. While some members of the MSR community were skeptical of her inexperience, others welcomed Arischetti's energy and drive. At first, says Jamie Jackson, former director at MSR's Children's Home, Arischetti seemed open to listening and learning from the school's faculty. But that didn't last long, her critic said. I think ultimately what Nancy's agenda was to be a rock star that made the circuit nationally about, look what this woman did. It wasn't so much what she did, her detractors say, but how she did it. She was harsh, she was brash, she was demoralizing, until all of the people who she felt were going to get in her way, a former teacher said. Some faculty members began to view her as a micromanager who brooked no dissent. Her tenure was tumultuous, says a teacher who left several years ago. Tyrant sounds like the right word. Staff morale was very rocky. Of course, these denunciations, sometimes from people with axes to grind, tell one side of the story. Indeed, the board thought highly enough of Arischetti not only to keep her around, but to give her at least two significant raises in 6 years, according to tax records and court documents. Arischetti notched several significant accomplishments at MSR. She oversaw the completion of a high school, which now features an international baccalaureate program, making MSR one of only three independent schools in the state to offer students the opportunity to earn an IB diploma. She supervised the construction of a new upper school building and led a successful capital campaign to fund it. During her tenure, the school also built a new high school gym, administrative offices, a new fine arts center, and broke ground on a soccer field. And earlier this year, the American Montessori Association re-accredited MSR with what the school describes as overwhelmingly positive feedback. Some of the tension between Arischetti and the school's faculty can be ascribed to cultural differences. Montessori schools tend to have less structured and more free-willing environments than traditional schools, with an emphasis on independent exploration, collaboration, and critical thinking. Arischetti, the Manhattan lawyer, wanted to get things done. it's not difficult to imagine how those approaches could clash. But it would be wrong to dismiss Arischetti's critics as a small contingent of malcontents. Meetings the board held with parents and faculty after Arischetti's arrest made clear the head of school had few allies among them. In recordings of these meetings provided to the Indy, parents and teachers grilled board members about their unflinching defense of Arischetti, the lack of trust within the school, and the fact that several popular teachers were shown the door without a good explanation, or at least an explanation that didn't smack of petty grievance. In April of 2017, after contracts with the next school year had already been signed, four faculty members went to the Board of Trustees with complaints about Arischetti's leadership and the morale problem they said it was causing. A fifth went on his own to the board president, while a sixth approached board members with questions about the school's leadership structure. By April 30, 2018, what one former teacher calls Massacre Monday, Arischetti had dispatched all but one of the six, four of their contracts not renewed for 2018-19, while another was fired during the 17-18 school year. In June and in August, two teachers whose contracts weren't renewed sued for wrongful termination. Both were among the group that approached the board, but they didn't claim that's why Arischetti fired them. Instead, they say, it's because they cooperated with the police investigation into Nick Smith. The first lawsuit, filed by Janie Jackson, lays out a timeline in support of her case. On April 19th, Jackson was given her students' roster and class assignments for the upcoming year, an indication that the school planned to keep her around. On April 24th, as part of the discovery process in the Johnson Law School, the school received a summary of Jackson's interview with the Raleigh police from November, the first time defendants became aware of plaintiff cooperating with the police. In that interview, the lawsuit says, Jackson told the police about an end-of-year party in 2015 in which a retiring teacher regaled the audience with a story about Smith getting drunk with students. Arischetti responded by putting her fingers in ears saying, "Stop! I don't want to hear this." On April 30th, the lawsuit says, Jackson was summoned to a meeting with Arischetti and told her services would no longer be needed. Arischetti refused to tell Jackson why her employment was being terminated beyond saying that she no longer fit the culture of the school where she had taught for 9 years. The second lawsuit, filed by a physical education teacher who had been an MSR for 17 years, tells a similar story. Chris Keehan's lawsuit says he spoke to police in November. The school found out in April, and he was let go a week later without being given a substantive reason. In his lawsuit, Keehan claims he personally witnessed Arischetti orally discouraging faculty and staff at MSR from cooperating or speaking with the Raleigh Police Department, and personally witnessed Arischetti orally telling faculty and staff at MSR, "Come to her with any information he thought was relevant to the police investigation," as opposed to giving it to the police. The school denies both teachers' claims. In a statement to the Indy in June, Joe Lewis said Jackson's lawsuit wrongfully attempts to tie her employment status to a tragic and unrelated event in our school's history. The decision not to renew this teacher's contract had absolutely nothing to do with her cooperation with the police. And in an email to MSR families in September, the board said Keehan was given specific reasons why his contract was not renewed, and those reasons were based entirely on his job performance and productivity. Part 3. Bright Future. By any measure, Nancy Arischetti had a horrible year. Last September, she suffered the sudden death of her oldest daughter, a junior at UNC Wilmington. 2 months later, Nick Smith was arrested. 2 months after that, the Johnsons sued Arischetti. 2 months after that, an anonymous letter circulated among MSR families accusing Arischetti and the school's leaders of holding the faculty in a state of fear and creating a culture of lies that led to a school that is broken beyond anything imaginable. And then, 2 months after that, Arischetti was arrested. The salacious story was picked up by the Associated Press. Her mugshot, watery eyes, disheveled, dyed blonde hair, betraying dark roots, a normally composed woman struggling to keep it together, was plastered all over the local news. It's hard to feel sympathy for her. In fact, says Anna Salter, a psychologist and expert on child predators, it's very dangerous to demonize these people. Salter says it's not surprising that school officials weren't more proactive. After all, Smith was well-liked. The most successful predators are those that are likable, she said. There seems to be a human tendency to trust people that we like and to distrust people that we don't like. So the best possible cover for a sex offender is to be likable, a person who is trusted and respected by other teachers in the school and the administration. There's also institutional loyalty to contend with, she said. It's not usually because the person who is defending the alleged perpetrator is an evil person. It is usually because they respond to social psychology forces. They don't want to look bad. They don't want the school to look bad. They don't want the hard work they've done to be undone. They can't believe the accusation. He's such a nice guy. Maybe he was just a little careless, but he wouldn't do anything really bad. The end result, Salter says, is that it's very rare for an institution to hear a report of inappropriate behavior and step back and treat that person objectively. This is a pernicious problem, according to Carol Shakeshift, a professor of educational leadership at Virginia Commonwealth University and an expert on educator sexual abuse. Nearly 1 in 10 students report being a target of school employee sexual misconduct, ranging from harassment to inappropriate jokes to rape between kindergarten and high school graduation. Shakespeare served on a task force commissioned by the National Association of Independent Schools, of which MSR is a member, and the Association of Boarding Schools, which released a report in March with recommendations for preventing abuse in schools. While better awareness has led to a decrease in the rate of child abuse and an increase in the percentage of incidents being reported, the report says, some schools have responded to incidents of educator sexual misconduct in ways that have further harmed survivors and failed to protect future students from abuse. The key, the report says, is effective leadership. Schools must not confuse institutional integrity with institutional reputation, it says. The truest measure of institutional strength is the integrity with which a school lives out its mission and values. In preventing and responding to educator sexual misconduct, a school may find its integrity put to the test. The strong leadership is needed to prevent educator sexual misconduct, to address allegations when they arise, and to the extent possible, to ameliorate the effects of that abuse when it does occur. Perhaps for that reason, law enforcement is taking a closer look at school leaders. It is starting to happen, Shakespeare says. The police and prosecutors are starting to bring charges. But these charges tend to be misdemeanors, enough for community service or probation, but not jail time. For example, in a Breakthrough 2012 case, A principal in San Jose, California, was given 2 years probation and community service after an 8-year-old student told her about a text teacher's sexual abuse, and she failed to report it. Last year in Massachusetts, the former director of a daycare was sentenced to 3 years probation and a $1,000 fine after being charged with reckless endangerment for failing to act on information that an intern was inappropriately touching children. In January, a Rhode Island elementary school principal was found guilty of failing to report allegations of sexual abuse and was given a 1-year suspended sentence and community service. The case against Arischetti is at once an extension of this trend and something more, though it's not clear what, if anything, sets this case apart. Prosecutor Melanie Schikita declined to discuss the charges and why she's seeking a felony conviction, beyond saying that she presented facts to a grand jury and the grand jury indicted Arischetti. It's possible the DA's office wants to use the felony charges as leverage against Steve Saad, the former prosecutor turned defense attorney. Shakeshift said Arischetti should have conducted a thorough investigation in 2002 when she was told about Smith's handholding with Stephanie Johnson. In 2016, when told that Smith had touched Kristen Johnson inappropriately, she should have contacted the authorities, or at minimum, fired him. That she didn't probably helps the Johnson's lawsuit, Saad says. That's where the failure to act becomes a liability. But criminally, I don't see it. They're never going to prove it. Despite the tribulations, the Montessori School of Raleigh did open this fall. In mid-July, the Board of Trustees told parents in an email, "We have been impressed with the quality and the quantity of applications received for our open positions. There's a deep pool of talented individuals excited about becoming part of the MSR community. Our school has a long, rich history and a bright future ahead." That bright future might soon include a date with the Wake County jury. A trial date in the Johnson's lawsuit is tentatively set for January, according to court documents. No matter what happens in court, though, even the school's harshest critics say they don't want it to run out of existence. They just want new leadership. On August 8th, they got their wish. The Board of Trustees announced that it had hired a new interim head of school, Jeannie Norris, whose previous experience included 16 years leading a private school in Massachusetts. "The Montessori School of Raleigh is focusing on our future and fulfilling our mission of educating children," Jolie told the Indy in a written statement. "Under the new leadership of an outstanding interim head of school, we are continuing to rebuild trust in the larger community and strengthen the values that have defined the Montessori School of Raleigh for the last 44 years. While MSR tries to move forward, Arischetti is still on the school's payroll. Though she's on administrative leave and has stepped away from the school operation, Arischetti continues to collect her $2,000 a year salary. In the 11 months since Nick Smith's arrest, no other students appear to have accused him of abuse. MSR says it has seen no evidence of any additional victims. But that doesn't mean they're not out there," says Anna Salter. "The fact that this man is accused of molesting two kids, even two kids from the same family, suggests that this is not an isolated instance." In an Inset article, this is entitled, "The Montessori Method." There are more than 4,000 accredited Montessori schools in the United States, and they've educated everyone from Jeff Bezos to Stephen Curry to Beyonce. The Montessori Method, developed by Italian educator Maria Montessori in the early 20th century, emphasizes child-directed education. The most distinctive component is the use of multi-age classrooms. The Montessori program is built around three-year cycles in which students remain in the same classroom for three consecutive years, with older kids matriculating out of that cycle and younger kids coming in. Learning alongside children of varying age mimics the outside world where students will work and socialize with people of all ages and dispositions, the American Montessori Society explains on its website. Another unique feature is a lack of graded work. The Montessori approach nurtures the motivation that comes from within, kindling the child's natural desire to learn, the MS said. A self-motivated learner also learns to be self-sufficient without needing reinforcements from the outside. Students complete classwork at their own pace, with teachers and administrators guiding them. Montessori teachers guide rather than instruct, the MS said, linking each student with activities that meet their interests, needs, and developmental level. The classroom is designed to allow movement and collaboration, as it also promotes concentration and a sense of order. This sort of pedagogy engenders more informal relations between teachers and their students. One of the unique things about MSR was the close relationship students had with their teachers, says former student, who was in middle school with Stephanie Johnson and had Nick Smith as a teacher. At the time, Smith's relationships with all his students, not just Stephanie, didn't seem weird. But having experienced plenty more student-teacher relationships in high school and college, I can now see how his relationships with all his students were actually a little weird. We turn now to the news section. An offer we can't refuse. A company wants to put free wayfinding kiosks in downtown Raleigh. The city council won't say yes. A company has proposed a new electronic kiosk system for downtown Raleigh that will connect people to the closest restaurant, share real-time transportation information, and spread community alerts, and taxpayers wouldn't have to pay for any of it. Last week, the city council declined, at least for now. Instead of allowing the legal department to explore tweaking city code to allow the kiosks, the council opted to explore different wayfinding options, with some city council members saying that they were concerned about light pollution, data breaches, and the kiosk advertisements that could transform downtown into Las Vegas. The council's reaction was disappointing, says Downtown Raleigh Alliance President and CEO Christopher Larson. The DRA has spent nearly 2 years working with kiosk vendors like Ike Smart City on the project. It didn't go as we had hoped it would go. I think that's clear, Larson said. There's a lot of change that's happening in this community, and change can be unsettling for folks. DRA had been looking into establishing a wayfinding system downtown since 2015, with the goal of replacing the current static map system. After selecting Ike Smart City as a vendor, the DRA presented information on the kiosk to the council in July of 2017. That November, council members unanimously voted to move forward, authorizing city work staff to work with the DRA and IKE on a plan to add 15 kiosks to downtown. What changed? We finally got to see what it really was, what saying yes really means, says city council member Kay Crowder. Seeing something hypothetically is one thing. But when you get down to the elements of reality, what that means in order to accomplish it, I was slightly taken aback by what that would mean for our current sign ordinance. Headquartered in Ohio, Ike Smart City installs 8-foot-tall touchscreen kiosks pedestrians can use like a tablet to find businesses nearby, search job postings, look up transportation options, and take government surveys and gain access to free Wi-Fi. Unlike content aggregated through online search engines, the kiosks display information based on proximity, promoting businesses that might not have the financial means to pay for search engine optimizations. The machines also collect pedestrian traffic data and monitor air quality. An emergency button to call 911 is optional. Ike covers the cost of installation and all ongoing maintenance fees in return for a cut in the revenue from the advertisements displayed on the screensaver when the kiosk is not in use. The DRA would receive about 15% of the ad revenues, about $200,000 a year, Larson estimates. Ike is in the process of launching in 15 markets throughout the country. In Denver, each of the company's 15 kiosks get an average of 1,422 users a day. The snag is that the city must update its strict sign ordinance to allow Ike's advertisements, which City Attorney Robin Tatum Curran says would need to apply to all signage in the district. While the city could write the ordinance as narrowly as possible, Curran says, the content in the ads can't be regulated. At a meeting last week, Councilmember David Cox said he saw little difference between the kiosk and a billboard. Russ Stevenson was concerned the kiosks could become vulnerable to hacking and wondered if a smartphone app could serve the same purpose. And Crowder put forth an extensive list of concerns, including light pollution and inundating downtown with ads. Though it's a very good and cool, I like lots of aspects of it, what it goes to our sign ordinances and text changing is alarming, Crowder said. I don't want this to look like Las Vegas. The city has a smartphone app, Larson said, but hardly anyone is using it. When it launched in 2016, 14,000 people downloaded. Last year, there were 8,000 downloads, and this year, DRA only expects 7,000. If you think about an analog from being in an airport or shopping mall, people download an app on their plane to figure out where they want to eat lunch. They use the Wayfinder directory, Link responded. Well, that's about it for this week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program isn't intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.